April is National Bilingual and Multilingual Learner Advocacy Month. That's why we're so excited to tell you about a new special series from Science of Reading, the podcast, that will launch later this month. Over several episodes, we'll talk to leading researchers and practitioners about how the science of reading serves multilingual and English learners, and how to best use the science of reading to support those students in the classroom. That's all starting at the end of this month. Stay tuned to this feed for more.
The vocabulary and language skills that a child takes into kindergarten are highly predictive and, one could even argue, determinative of subsequent progress in learning to read.
This is Susan Lambert, and welcome to Science of Reading, the podcast from Amplify, where the science of reading lives. We're wrapping up our season focused on the critical role of knowledge. And if there's been one takeaway, it's that knowledge building cannot be overlooked for literacy development and beyond. So while season 8 is coming to an end, we will certainly continue coming back to knowledge building in our future episodes. To close out this season, we've got a fascinating conversation in store with Dr. Catherine Snow, the John and Elizabeth Hobbs Professor of Cognition and Education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. On this episode, Dr. Snow looks back at the Preventing Reading Difficulties in Young Children report and shares some of the most critical takeaways for educators today. She also weighs in on the state of the current science of reading movement and shares what's on the top of her mind in this moment. Please enjoy this conversation with Dr. Catherine Snow. It's so nice to have you here, Dr. Snow. Could you tell our listeners just a little bit more about the work that you do and maybe your initial interest in language development?
My initial interest in language development started actually when I was a graduate student, and I was reading, of course, the work of Noam Chomsky, who was the expert of that era in language analysis and language acquisition. And I was struck, first of all, by the brilliance of the linguistic analysis, but also by a bit of incredulity when I read his descriptions of linguistic input to children as being garbled and ungrammatical. And it seemed to me that this was actually an empirical claim that could be tested. And so that's where I started, by collecting interactions between mothers and children and analyzing them to discover that they were, of course, not as garbled and ungrammatical as the language that Noam Chomsky had evidently been listening to at linguistic conferences among his colleagues.
Did anything really surprise you about what you were learning at that time related to mothers and children?
Well, it's the sort of finding that when you go home and tell your grandmother, she says, well, didn't you know that? Of course people talk in a way that's simpler and more repetitive and more concrete and more here and now with young children. But it was important to document it because linguists were proceeding from the assumption that the linguistic input was very, very difficult to parse, very difficult to make sense of, very difficult to connect to meaning, and thus that there needed to be an extremely powerful innate language acquisition device. So it was important just to moderate, I think, that claim about the strength of the size, the power of the innate language acquisition device.
And so I think I have this right, but I hear a lot of conversation about how language in children, you know, children are sort of born to be communicators, and language is something that actually starts to develop before babies are born, but actually has an impact later on. So do I have that right about sort of this natural bent towards language development?
You certainly have it right about a natural desire for connection and communication. That's very much there from very early on. We know that even what babies hear prenatally has some influence. So they're evidently sort of processing language. making distinctions, learning what's familiar and thus, by implication, what's not familiar. But that's quite a different claim from the claim that language is innate. So communication, communicative desires, and understanding social meaning is certainly very early. Babies look at moving mouths. They look at eyes. They're quite young when they start to engage in proto-conversations, sort of back and forth babbling. But the adult or the older speaker who's interacting with the child can make a lot of those initial communicative efforts or can ignore them and suppress them. Hmm. And the value of the environment in exploiting those social and communicative tendencies is huge.
Hmm. And so you said there's sort of a difference between communication and language. I think one of the things that I've noticed is that I really believe that many of us as educators and practitioners, and I'm going to put myself in that camp too, because I'm not sure that I completely understood language. What is then language? Could you define it? And is that too much to ask?
Probably. But certainly language is an extremely multi-layered communicative system that operates with rules that many of which in most natural languages are somewhat arbitrary. Mm. So language requires learning, being sensitive to, picking up on, and learning a lot of things that aren't really necessary for communication. I mean, if you think about gender, three genders in German, are those necessary for communication? Well, evidently not, because we don't have those three genders in English. But they are necessary to become a good speaker of German. So the complexities, the additional rules that actually constitute natural languages, and which children pick up on. Children don't have any particular problem learning three genders in German or two in Spanish and learning how they operate, suggests that children are very sensitive to certain kinds of regularities and certain kinds of feedback from the environment about how to communicate most effectively. That goes well beyond the kind of communication that you see in a 14-month-old, which consists of pointing or offering objects, saying things like hi and bye-bye and thank you and all gone, which are not yet really well-structured linguistic forms, but they are very powerful communicative forms.
Hmm. And so then the link between language and its impact on literacy. So we know there's a connection there, and we know that kids come to school with more or less language experiences, and those experiences actually impact literacy. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So the dimension of language that has been shown to have the strongest impact on literacy is vocabulary, the size of a child's vocabulary. And this is remarkably variable among normally developing children. Normally developing children might arrive at kindergarten knowing 1,000 words in English or knowing 5,000 words in English. And that difference has been shown to make a huge difference, a difference that predicts ease of word reading during the first phase of teaching children decoding. And you might think, well, why? What difference does it make? Well, English is an alphabetic language, but it is what we refer to as it has what we call a deep orthography. That is to say, there's not a one-to-one correspondence between letters and sounds, as there is in languages that were first written down much more recently. And so that means that kids have to learn not just to decode, in other words, to look at a letter and make the sound, but to think, is that really a word? Mm-hmm. So, for example, a child reading the word get, he gets hungry in the afternoon, would, if he or she were thinking about the rule that G before E typically makes the J sound, would say he jets hungry in the afternoon. And only if you then think, does that make sense? Are you likely to correct that error of decoding and really be able to use the decoding process, the word reading process, to contribute to the meaning making process, which is the point of reading.
Very interesting. And, you know, sort of developing new vocabulary and growth over time, that's one thing that continues through our lifetime, as long as we're learning new things, as opposed to the decoding process, right? Which once you have it secure, you're pretty much done with it.
That's right. The decoding is typically in languages with much more shallow orthographies than English, languages like Spanish, let's say, where there are only a few variations on that phoneme, grapheme linkage, takes a few months. Now, it takes more time to get it really automatized, to get it really fluent, but the basic system is mastered in a few months. In English, it often takes 2 or 3 years to kind of learn all of the rules that make you not just a good decoder, but also a good speller. But on the other hand, during that time, consulting the meaning-making system helps, because it helps you correct the mistaken readings that you otherwise are very subject to in a deep orthography like English.
I think that's a really good point to maybe put an exclamation point on, in that in the early grades, when we're teaching kids to decode, we should not be giving up on their language development. That should also be a really important part of what's happening in the classroom. Do you agree with that?
I absolutely agree with that. And particularly agree with that for the kids who arrive in first grade with fewer vocabulary words, because they are now going to be dependent on teachers and literate input in order to expand their vocabulary, so they have a better chance later on of comprehending the texts they'll be expected to read in social studies in fifth grade or in science in sixth grade. And some of that can start pretty early and with easily decoded words. I mean, if you think about the way many kids get into the alphabetic principle, is with lists of words like hog, log, fog, nog, pog. But do they know? Is that a real word? Well, some teaching methods will say it doesn't matter. If they read it and sound it out correctly, then that's good instruction, and that's even good assessment to know if they can do that. But I would argue that we should be thinking about sets of words like all the og rhymes as an opportunity to teach children new word meanings while they're practicing these patterns. So they might not know what fog means, for example. Well, that's a perfect chance to teach a new meaning and to talk about fog and what it is, not just stick to make sure you pronounce it correctly.
That makes sense. Well, we're going to come back to this little bit of language in a few minutes, but many, many people may not know about a report that you were quite instrumental in developing. I love your story here too, of how you ended up doing this, but can you talk a little bit about this National Research Council report called Preventing Reading Difficulties in Young Children, and how you ended up doing it and what this report was about?
Sure. In 1995, the National Research Council, which is the operating arm of the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine, decided that the research had accumulated to a point where it should be possible to end the reading wars, which had, of course, been going on since for 150 years, actually, but quite viciously since the Second World War. But there was, by 1995, a very large and pretty coherent body of research about reading development and reading instruction and the predictors of good reading outcomes. So they decided to put together a study, which means basically a committee, to review this evidence and write a report. And the problem was that the reading wars were still pretty hot in 1995. And so it's possible in one of these committees, of course, to balance the membership, to bring in some people who are sort of more on the decoding phonics side and people who are more on the meaning-making, read-for-pleasure side. But the person who chairs the committee sends an important political signal. And it was decided that everybody who had ever published in the field of reading and reading instruction was thus disqualified because they would already be identified as one side or the other. So there I was. I had not ever published in the field of reading instruction, certainly reading education. I'd published a couple of papers about very early literacy and how it relates to language. So they tapped me to chair this committee, and I was reluctant. But anyway, I ended up chairing the committee, which turned out to be actually an extremely instructive experience for me, and also remarkably free, I think, of aggression or severe disagreements. We ended up producing a report that everybody on the committee signed off on. Mm-hmm. And these were people who came from a wide range of positions on how to teach reading. But we agreed on some very important principles. And so that became the report, Preventing Reading Difficulties, which came out in 1998.
And I actually have a copy of this report sitting right here on my desk. So isn't that pretty impressive that I have it here? And some of the people, I just want to read some of the names on the committee: Marilyn Yeager Adams, Barbara Foreman, Claude Goldenberg. Some of the names that we continue to hear: Charles Perfetti, Hollis Scarborough, Sally Shaywitz. So you worked with some really important and influential researchers on this committee.
That's right. And they all signed off on it.
That's quite amazing. So this report actually came out before the National Reading Panel report, which came out not that much after. Is that correct?
That's right. And you might be wondering why we needed two reports. And I wondered that too at the time, I have to say. And I think I know that people who sat on the National Reading Report Committee wondered that. Several of them called me up and said, "You've really done all the work with the Preventing Reading Difficulties report. I'm not quite sure what we're doing." But they did undertake a different approach by looking primarily at instructional research and primarily at or exclusively at research that was quasi-experimental or experimental. And so ideally, the National Reading Panel report would have been the perfect complement to Preventing Reading Difficulties because the conclusions were quite consistent, but the Preventing Reading Difficulties report was broader. It started from early childhood before there was instructional research to be reported. It took a developmental perspective rather than an instructional perspective. And it took a sort of a public health perspective, one that anticipated the notion of a three-tiered system. You know, what's good enough to ensure reading development for everybody? What do you do when some kids are struggling a little bit? What do you do when kids are struggling a lot? But in effect, I'll have to say, the National Reading Panel report, which should have been taken as a complement to Preventing Reading Difficulties, was instead presented as an improvement upon the Preventing Reading Difficulties report. And that was really unfortunate because I think it then sort of eclipsed Preventing Reading Difficulties after a couple of years and has limited what we think of as literacy instruction, because it limited it to those five domains in which there was a sufficient quantity of work that met their criteria. And that means that it says nothing about writing, which is a very valuable route to learning to read and learning to comprehend. It says nothing about sustained silent reading. I mean, it says basically we can't say anything about it because there's not enough data supporting its value. But that was taken by many educators as meaning we shouldn't do it, rather than as meaning we're neutral on whether we should do it. Mm. And I think those omissions have constrained reading instruction in the last 25 years.
We'll be right back with more from Dr. Catherine Snow. Throughout this Knowledge Focus season, we've shared short messages from educators across the country with their advice on building knowledge. For this season finale, we're going to hear directly from a couple of students. We ask young people to tell us about their favorite classroom topics, and here are a couple of their lovely messages.
Hi, my name is Julian. I am in third grade. I am 8 years old. My favorite topic in CKLA is the human body. I love learning about joints and muscles and skeletons because they're all interesting and they all have different parts and they all have different jobs to work for your body.
Hi, my name is Joy and I'm 10. I go to French public school and I love reports in French class because I learned so much throughout the research. Recently, I did a report on Moby Dick with a friend, in French, of course. I also love reading because it inspires me to write my own stories. Bye!
Thank you so much, Julian and Joy, for sharing that with us. And please keep us posted on your next scientific discoveries and your next reports. And now, back to our conversation with Dr. Catherine Snow.
So what I hear you say is you really see the preventing reading difficulties, the National Reading Panel report, as complementary. What would you hope that folks would, well, I think you would hope that folks would go back and look at the preventing reading difficulties report. What would you hope that some of the takeaways for them would be as they go back and look at that?
One takeaway is certainly that we need to start early for precisely the reason you mentioned, that the vocabulary and language skills that a child takes into kindergarten are highly predictive and one could even argue determinative of subsequent progress in learning to read. And that what that means is that part of preventing reading difficulties means focusing on programs to ensure that all children have access to books from early childhood, that they have access to adults who will read those books with them and discuss them, because that is a very powerful source of learning vocabulary. And I'm taking vocabulary here not as so much an end in itself, but as the marker for knowledge. Kids who have larger vocabularies have clearly learned more about the world. If you know the word gravity, or you know the word volcano, or you know the word tidal pool, that probably means you know about three domains of knowledge that might come up in books later on, or that might give you an opportunity to ask questions of adults and further enrich your knowledge. So the access to knowledge, as well as the access to imagination, of course, to fantasy, to creativity. The other domain that is very much emphasized in preventing reading difficulties and that was not accessible to the methods of the National Reading Panel report was motivation, love, enjoyment. I mean, kids don't learn to read so that they can pronounce words correctly. They learn to read so that they can have fun reading good stories, so they can learn about topics that are of interest to them, so they can pursue their own curiosity. And that early looking at books, talking about books with an affectionate adult sets the stage for sort of a positive attitude toward learning to read. The opportunity to read books that children select themselves reinforces the sense that this is an authentic, valuable activity. It isn't an exercise in demonstrating skills. And that, I think, is a crucial piece of creating a good learning environment for literacy that we've maybe started to neglect a little bit. Recent NAEP scores have shown, for example, that American children have a very large proportion of them rarely read for pleasure, and that the frequency with which they read for pleasure is, of course, unsurprisingly closely related to their skill, their performance on the NAEP test. So reading for pleasure makes you a better reader, but being a reader for many children means reading for pleasure, not reading to get this worksheet done or reading to get this piece of homework done.
Yeah, yeah. You also write a lot about, you know, more recently than the preventing reading difficulties, you've written about academic language and why that's important. Can you talk a little bit about what academic language is and why it's important for us to develop that for students?
Sure. So academic language has become a slightly fraught term. But if we just assume that what we mean by it is the kind of language skills that are displayed by literate people, by people who read a lot and who talk about ideas and theories and generalizations, and the kind of language that's much more frequent in texts than in oral language, I think that's a neutral definition of academic language. It is clearly not language that we want to teach children to use all the time.
Right.
I mean, yep. None of us should walk around sounding like Harvard professors all the time, only when we need to sound like Harvard professors. And in that case, it's useful to know words like mitigate and proportionately and putatively. But, you know, when you're playing ball in the backyard, those words don't do you much good. There are a lot of other words that are more helpful. But I see academic language and exposure to academic language as an expansion of children's language skills that both contributes to successful literacy, successful reading comprehension, and gets built through encounters with texts, but also encounters with oral activities like engaging in debates or engaging in discussions of big ideas and important questions.
That's great. And yes, nobody wants to walk around sounding like a Harvard professor all the time. That is a really great comment. So you have, you know, you talked a little bit about the context for the preventing reading difficulties, the reading wars. Chuckle about that a little bit because they maybe should have been ended back in the 2000s. Who knows? But we're still in the middle of it. And now instead of the reading wars, I think we're calling it the Science of Reading movement. This is Science of Reading, the podcast. So I'd just love to hear your thoughts on both the Science of Reading movement, but also, you know, why haven't the reading wars ended? Why are we still debating years later about what's best for developing literacy in children?
That's a very good question. I am not the right person to analyze what the incentives are for keeping the reading wars going, although, of course, I could speculate about that. I think there are very good and moral reasons to worry about reading in American society. There are still huge inequities in reading success. There are schools and neighborhoods where children have a much harder time learning to read. There is, however, as far as I can tell, no basis for assuming there's a crisis. Reading scores are, on average, pretty much where they were 20 years ago. I mean, a very small increment in the NAEP over those 20 years in the NAEP reading scores, except for the dip associated with COVID, which you can attribute to not poor reading instruction, but to the absence of reading instruction, suggesting that when kids are in school, they are actually learning from whatever is going on. Now, one of the questions is, what is going on in classrooms? We really don't know. there's not a good database for the nature of reading instruction. I mean, you can track what curricula are being purchased, but we do not track whether they're taken out of the box. We do not track whether the professional development that allowed teachers to use those curricula was completed or was embraced by the teachers. So attributing lack of progress in the NAEP to insufficient attention to the science of reading, which I always have to put into air quotes for reasons I can explain, or to over-reliance on any particular method is, I think, an imaginative interpretation, unmarred by data. The science of reading, I think, is not really a movement. I mean, it's a political movement. It's not a scientific movement. And the science of reading has become a slogan that means whatever you want it to mean in your school district or your corner of the reading world. There is a lot of science about reading now. There's lots more than we had access to in 1998 when we published Preventing Reading Difficulties, or that reading panel report writers had access to in 2000. There's lots more. But is there a science of reading? No, there's a lot of science about reading. And there's a lot of science about reading predictors of good reading, and science about reading instructional methods. There's not so much science about the implementation of those methods or variation in the implementation of those methods. So I don't like the term the science of reading. I've looked at various websites and different districts' websites and it gets interpreted very differently in different places depending on what people think is the most important missing ingredient. I don't think it's as a term promoting our effective communication. Mm-hmm. But it's there. And so if it's there, let's try to think of it as science about reading and not science of reading.
Hmm. I like that, because what you said is this is kind of we're going to unpack this a little bit. You feel like this is a little bit of a political movement and not a scientific movement. And so I'm wondering, so I've heard this from reading researchers before. We've known this. We've been studying this for a long time. This isn't new information to us. But what about it getting into the teachers that are teaching in the classroom, their understanding of language development or their understanding of word reading development? Do you think that we've done a good job of translating that scientific research to those that are actually working in the field?
No. I don't. And I actually don't think translate is the right metaphor there. I think translate suggests, you know, if you can just put this into simpler language, then teachers will get it. And the basic nature of what reading researchers want to do and what teachers want to do is convergent at a very far point in the distant future, but in the daily activity, it's quite different. Reading researchers want to make generalizations. Mm. First grade teachers want to help Kenny, who's in the last row and doesn't know the alphabet yet, right? So the focus is quite different. Keith Stanovich has written a wonderful paper about this, in which he lays out these differences between researchers' needs and individual teachers' needs. But as a result, I think what teachers need is not a translation of our research findings, and I think they certainly not a lot of reproaches about what they're doing wrong, which tends to be how much of the research is translated into messages for teachers. Oh no, that's a bad technique. Oh no, don't do that. Oh no, that's very stupid. I think what they need is tools, things that they can use that are available to help them figure out what does Kenny need and what does Malaika need and what does Sylvia need and how do I provide that, even though it might be three somewhat different things. And those tools are complicated, particularly in a first grade classroom where you've got kids ranging in level from barely emergent readers to highly fluent readers who really don't just want you to go away and not try to teach them anything because they'd rather be reading Harry Potter. But that isn't how the curricular packages, the instructional techniques that we give are usually packaged, right? They're less personalized, they're less usable for every kid in the class. So I would argue that teachers need some tools which are also forms of knowledge, but the forms of knowledge have to be connected very directly to the kids that they are facing right now, this year, every year.
Hmm. And can you give us maybe some examples of what those tools might be that a teacher could have to use in her toolbox?
Sure. Well, one set of tools would be quick diagnostics of, for first graders, let's say, quick diagnostics of what phoneme, grapheme linkages a child is struggling with, and then a game or a computer program or an interactive activity that's targeted directly at that problem, right? So kids often have trouble with ch, sh. Okay, so in 5 15-minute sessions of the right game, you can get kids to reliably notice and pronounce correctly the difference between chip and ship and cheat and sheet and so forth. But out of 30 kids, 15 might not need that at all.
Right.
For 5, it might be way too early because they're still struggling with single consonants. For another 10, it might be completely unnecessary. They figured it out on their own. So it's this problem of identifying what does each child, what would help each child at this point in time. Mm-hmm. And that means good targeted diagnostics, not words per minute, not number of phonemes that you can segment, but specific diagnostics. What is this child struggling with? That in the old days was what you got from sitting next to a kid and listening to him read for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Teachers don't typically have the chance to do that nowadays.
That makes sense. So in thinking about this, where we are right now with, we'll put it in quotes, our listeners can't see this, but I'm putting in quotes, the science of reading movement, I think I want to know two things from you. What are your hopes for the future in terms of supporting teachers and helping them in the classroom? And what are some of your fears about what's happening in the movement right now?
Well, my hopes would be that we can think better in relationship with teachers, in partnership with teachers about what they need, about what would help them, with this recognition that the components of good reading instruction involve not just personalization, sort of targeted, little targeted sort of interventions, let's say, like the ch-sh intervention, but also supports to teachers to create the classroom conditions that we know are good for all students. Rich language environment, interesting topics, lots of opportunity for students to contribute, to talk, to work on projects or on problems in pairs or in small groups so that they get more airtime than they normally get in a classroom where they're meant to be silently working on worksheets. So if there were a message that I think teachers have not heard that they would probably be happy to hear, it's let your classroom be noisier. Let the kids be more engaged and more socially engaged, because that is actually a contribution to their language development and to their motivation to keep working. Mm. The bigger, I guess, umbrella point is that so much of what kids do in school is done from their point of view because we tell them to do it rather than because they understand why they should be doing it. And moving toward learning specific skills because the larger learning task in which those specific skills are embedded is actually something that motivates children's interest. You can learn letter sound correspondence or you practice letter sound correspondence from writing a classroom newsletter as well as from filling in a worksheet.
Hmm.
My worst fears? Well, they're, of course, that we're just going to keep swinging this pendulum back and forth that will push first and second grade classrooms so far toward time investment in phonics, in the programs that teach phonics in a relatively disembodied, decontextualized way, that that kids are losing motivation, that they don't get a chance to read stuff, to understand what this phonics teaching is helping them do that they want to do, and that the scores won't go up. And then we'll say, well, gee, that didn't work. Let's drop that and go back to teaching using literature and self-expression and creativity. And that's not going to work either. I mean, both of these components are crucial, but they've got to be put together in a way that makes sense from the child's point of view and from the teacher's point of view.
Well, do you have any final words of advice or wisdom for those practitioners that are trying to make this work every single day in districts across the country, or actually across the world?
Around the world, that's true. Well, that I think one of the positive effects of COVID was that parents came to appreciate how hard their job is. And so that's good that we know how hard teachers work. And, you know, when you walk into a first grade classroom with 25 kids all working busily on useful tasks, it's breathtaking. But unfortunately, the classroom next door is probably not that breathtaking. So that's one of the challenges we have. I would say to those teachers, if you're doing this and making progress and learning how to do it better, please hang in there for a while.
Yes. It is very hard work, and we do appreciate all that our educators are doing. And Dr. Snow, we appreciate you coming on and just sharing some of your wisdom with us, sharing the legacy of how you came to be interested in language development. And thanks for your contributions.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to my conversation with Dr. Catherine Snow, John and Elizabeth Hobbs, Professor of Cognition and Education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. Don't forget to check out the show notes for links to some of the resources we discussed. If you missed any of the 12 episodes in Season 8, please scroll back in your podcast feed or visit our website to check them out. There's so much good stuff on read-alouds, vocabulary building, and so much more that you don't want to miss. Or maybe you want to listen again. While this is the end of Season 8, we will certainly continue focusing on knowledge and knowledge building in episodes to come. We've already got a special series in the works on a brand new topic. I can't wait to tell you more. Stay tuned to this podcast feed for more information on that, as well as a few timely episodes from our archives. The best way to stay up to date with the show is to subscribe to the podcast on any and all podcasting apps. Also, make sure to join our Facebook discussion group, Science of Reading the Community. Science of Reading the Podcast is brought to you by Amplify. For more information on how Amplify leverages the science of reading, go to amplify.com/CKLA. Lastly, if you liked Season 8, please consider rating us and leaving us a review. It will help more people find the show. Thank you again for listening.